Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Glad to have you all here this morning. It looks like we're starting with case number two, as we haven't heard from attorneys in case number one yet. So we'll start with case number two, and I've got all of your times set forth. I know it's a little confusing, but I wanted to make sure everybody had time to get to their issues at some point. So we're calling Severs and Gowden and Mira Vista versus Mira Vista and Severs. Cause number 216-157-CV. And I believe we have Mr. Bobo starting first.
Counsel,
the court, good to see everybody again. It's been a long time. Two dramatic things happen if you uphold the summary judgment. One, you're going to take probably about 100 years of HOA law and you're going to stand it on its head. And two, you're going to basically say that governing documents, dedicatory documents, whatever you want to call them, basically don't matter because an HOA board or an ACC can essentially do whatever they want to do. You know, the Severs move into Mira Vista, and it's a double-edged sword when you move into a neighborhood that has HOA docs. On the one hand, you're provided the protections. On the other hand, you're restricted from doing certain things. The Severs pick out their home, which is set back from the golf course, knowing full well what the restrictions are, knowing what the side setbacks are, knowing what can and can't be done with regards to their neighbors. That was a primary consideration for the reason that they bought their home. And so when this process started and made a significant change, that's how this litigation started. There's obviously 10 issues. There's a lot. The summary judgment was held over 2 days, but I want to focus on three primary things. One is the rebuttable presumption issue. Two is the arbitrary, capricious, and discriminatory issue. And then the third are the examples under the arbitrary provision. The other issues, unless the court would like to discuss, I'll leave to my brief. And then obviously at the end, we have an attorney's fees component to this as well. Texas courts are very clear that HOA's interpretation of its covenants is not entitled to the presumption of reasonableness granted by Texas Property Code 202.004, absent specific discretionary authority in those covenants. Texas courts unanimous. This court in the last 6 or 7 years in both Leak and Whittier Heights have upheld that proposition. Now, it's interesting when you look at all the cases that deal with HOAs and how they're cited, there's not one out there that has a global discretionary authority granted, which makes sense, because if there was a global discretionary authority, why would you even have the documents? Because if they could just change them at will, there's no reason to have dedicatory documents.
So it's not enough in that we have Article 10 and Article 5 both say it's in the ACC's sole discretion to grant variances. That's not enough to get you there?
It's not enough, and here's why. Because the cases specific, when they talk about these, they have specific issues they talk about. Like in Leak, it was whether or not we can do a fee assessment. Whittier Heights, it was whether or not we can make this specific approval process. And what's interesting about those two sections, and they actually cite four sections that they think are important. Article 10, subsection B, actually says no structure of any type can be built absent submission and approval of the plans. That's really all subsection B says. D in 5.15 only deal with the situation where a variance has been submitted and requested, and it goes through what you can do when that happens. In this case, no variance was ever submitted, no variance was ever requested.
The argument that you're trying to make, if I understand it correctly, Mr. Bobo, is in this case, since we have the construction going forward without going to the committee, there would have never been a request for a variance, therefore that provision wouldn't apply. Is that correct?
Well, that's an interesting argument that Mira Vista makes, because what they want to say is, well, we have this modified design review process that applies to remodels. First of all, that argument's completely unsupported by the documents. They apply certain parts of the approval process, and certainly part of the approval process is variance. And so depending on what part of the approval process Mira Vista wants to apply to a remodel, certainly a variance could be requested. But I think what's important for purposes of section Article 10D and 5.15 is they are specific as to situations where a variance has been requested. That is not a global That does not give the AC discretionary authority to change any type of the entire process or the design guidelines or the declaratory documents. All it talks about is in this case, they can certainly use their discretion under these parameters in such a situation where variance is requested. And that's not the situation we have here. In those, that section, when you read it closely, it doesn't give them a global grant or anything. It only is specific as to variances. And I think when you look at the document as a whole, and when you go through and it talks all the different places where they talk about where would a situation be, how is this going to apply, how are we going to make these decisions, it's in the documents. It's laid out for them how they're going to do that. Only in a variance situation do they have that discretion. And E, Article 10E, says it gives the right, the HOA the right to issue design guidelines, which they do in this case, but it says they must be uniformly applied. There is absolutely nowhere in any of these documents that gives them a discretionary authority to change what the governing documents say. Nor is there a specific provision like in Leek and Whittier Heights. Now, so I think the analysis for our purposes ends there. Because if you look at the documents, and we're talking about the declarations and the design guidelines, if the court finds that they don't, there is not specific discretionary authority, then they got you have to overturn the summary judgment because they're not entitled to the next part, which is let's get to the reasonable presumption. If the court is inclined to entertain and say, well, maybe I think that they do are granted some discretionary authority, then they have to say, okay, we get past the reasonable presumption. Let's go to this issue of whether or not the HOA's actions were arbitrary, capricious, or discriminatory. Now, the courts that address this issue, they talk about arbitrary is without reference to any guiding rules or principles outside the authority. Definition is depending on individual discretion, rather without regard to fixed rules, procedures, and law. When you look at all the evidence in this case, and you overlay what happened on top of what the declarations and the design guidelines say, there is no doubt that what they did was arbitrary. I'm going to use three examples. 2.1 is the first one, which deals with a 15-foot side setback. Article 1, the design guidelines, statement of purpose, created to provide directions for the improvement of the properties. Nor shall there be any addition to or change to the exterior of any resident or other structure or improvement, except in compliance with these plans and specifications. Architectural design standard 3.13, changes or additional construction, all changes or additions to. 5, Article 5, design review process, any proposed improvement, subsequent changes, additional construction. When you read 2.1, it is very clear, the approval process, when you go through the approval process, it doesn't ever allow them to say there's some modified process out there because it's a remodel. And not only that, but at volume 2, page 936, they file this notice of restrictions, and it says applies to all future, present and future lot and homeowners. These restrictions and the design guidelines referenced in said restrictions require, among other things, underlined that prior to any and all construction and improvements, including but not limited to the following, residences, additions and repairs to existing residences. So you have the design guidelines and the declarations that clearly lay out that this is any and all improvements, any construction. You have something that Mira Vista files in the deed restrictions that underlines and specifically says this applies to remodels. And yet Mira Vista's arguments from Mr. Youngblood and Mr. Ross, they simply say the ACC is not bound to follow the approval process for remodels. You don't need to look anywhere else but Article 5. Common sense of the ACC alone dictates what applies to the design review process. They also testify, both of them, at Volume 2, page 776, and Volume 2, page 814, when questioned, can you show me anywhere in the governing documents that it says that? They unequivocally say, no. We just make it up as we go. We've always done it that way. It's also interesting that Mira Vista makes a big point to say, well, we found out that this builder had started construction without getting a building permit, so we fined him $250 and made him stop. Well, that's interesting because they basically want to apply some parts of the approval process, but they just kind of decide what other parts aren't going on. They basically want to have their cake and their eat it too. But again, they can't point you to anything. They admit there's nothing there that says that. They're just making it up as they go, and that's not what the law says.
Well, What about their argument, however, that some improvements had been made previously, and they had been made and completed even before the Severs moved in?
That's great. When the Severs move into their house, they know what that house is. They know whatever's been done before has been done before. I get that. What they also know is because when Mayor Vista said, here's the rules, here's the rules, and nothing can be done outside of these rules, that they are comfortable that nobody's going to build within the side setback of 15 feet. Because regardless of what had happened before, when they build their house, they're handed the rules, they want to argue, well, this was just going up. This is existing structure. That's not what the documents say. That's not what the declarations, the design guidelines say. They say any improvement, any remodel, any construction at all has to go through this approval process.
So even though it has or retains the same footprint, your position is that they should have sought a variance to begin with?
They have to, according to the declarations and the design guidelines, and there's no out not to.
And would that have given their neighbors maybe advance notice of about what was going to happen or take place?
Well, arguably, if you go through the design approval process the way that it's supposed to be done, there are several points along the way where the Severs have the opportunity to go, hey, listen, this is affecting us this way. This is not in line with the design guidelines. Here's the process. There's hearings. There's meetings. There's all these things that you have to go through, which makes sense. That's the whole point of going through this process. Because they make, if you read the declarations, they make a big deal of this is all construction improvements. This is all about the neighborhood and making sure we don't affect any of our neighbors and adjacent lots, and we care about that and we're concerned about that. That's all in those documents. It's they're replete with them. And there's a reason, because that's the process they're supposed to go through. As a 2.1, it's clear and unambiguous. No portion of any residential structure may be constructed closer to a property line than established below. In the event of a conflict, greater setback shall prevail. It says side setback 15 feet. 9.05 of the declarations. No structure improvement of any kind shall be near to the side property line of any lot. The first argument to make is, well, that 2.1 is the only provision in the entire design guidelines that doesn't apply to phase one. Again, it doesn't say that. And again, in two documents, volume 2, 904 through 916, and volume 2, 936, there are two different filings in the Tarrant County deed records that specifically say this applies to all the lots, and 916 specifically identifies the garden by house and lot number as one that's covered in this in the deed restrictions that are filed. Now,
under your theory, are there any circumstances in this case where the ACC could have granted a variance to allow the homeowners to do what they did?
If they abide by their overall premise of we take everybody into consideration, I don't think so, and here's the reason why. And this is important. The Severs lot is set back. It's on the golf course, but it is set back further than their neighbors. So they have a backyard and a big upstairs deck, which is where they do most of their stuff in the backyard. The way this house went, because the Gowden's house is further up in the lot, that wall goes basically 20 feet straight up, and it's just a straight brick wall. I think if they would have gone through that process and said, this is what this is going to look like, and if they would have adhered to their, what they say is their provisions, I don't think there's any way that they would have ultimately said, yeah, that's okay, that's consistent with throwing up a big wall. I don't think they would have gotten there. They say two things on the 2.1. They say that we had a developer's meeting in 1992, and we think that was in the minutes. And then we have this rule of thumb. Ask for 10, expect 8, but the city asked for 5. Where in it does it say that you can't apply 2.1 that doesn't apply to phase 1? I can't show you that because it's not there. And and again, what's also interesting, throughout this process, they take this position that, hey, it doesn't apply to phase 1. And I would urge the court, and we cite it in our brief, but volume 2, 843 to 863 and 932, 940 are specific examples of residences in phase 1 where there were remodels of construction done, where the ACC specifically says 2.1 design guidelines, there's a 15-foot side setback. So to take the position that it doesn't apply when they have previously applied it numerous times is, quite frankly, an absurd position to take. 2.9, if you take Mira Vista at their word, then 2.9 clearly applies to phase one. 2.9 is clear. Any exterior mechanical equipment utilized must be ground-mounted adjacent to the residence and must be enclosed by walls, fencing, or landscape of sufficient height and density to screen equipment from view and to buffer sound as well. Volume 2, 955 through 960. Some of these pumps were added as part of this remodel. They are not adjacent to the house. They are right up against the Seavers fence line. The shrubs are actually the Seavers shrubs, not the Gowdens, and the fence that is built around the pull pumps in the AC units basically filters all the noise directly into the Seavers backyard. When I asked Mira Vista about it, he said, yeah, those, they have to abut the house. Those don't abut the house. I agree with you, and they don't do anything about it. Simply put, it is completely arbitrary how they have applied 2.1, 2.9 in the approval process. Even if you get past the rebuttal presumption, you can't look at all of this and go, this was reasonable and not arbitrary. My light went off. I'll save the rest of my rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bobo. Let's see. Now we have Mr. Yanoff. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you're arguing for Mira Vista.
I am, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Mike Yanoff and I represent Mira Vista Homeowners Association. I want to start with Justice Pittman's first question that you asked. You asked, is it enough to say the ACC has discretion in order to invoke the discretion to create the presumption under the property code, the presumption that the actions are reasonable? Counsel for the Seavers has at least sort of addressed Article 5.15 and said it's a variance procedure. That's not what it is. It's a variance or a waiver procedure. It expressly is titled that, and that's what it describes. It is not simply a procedure whereby the Homeowners Association or the ACC can grant a variance. This case has nothing to do with the variance. A variance wasn't requested or granted in this case. It allows the ACC expressly to waive certain procedures in order to streamline the process. That's what it says.
Are you referring to the first sentence of 5.15? The ACC reserves the right to waive or vary any of the procedures or standards set forth herein at its discretion for good cause shown?
Yes, Your Honor.
What was the good cause shown in this case? It's in the record.
The good cause shown is that this is a phase one structure. The evidence in this case, primarily from the affidavit of David Ross, states that almost all of the phase one structures are inside of the 15-foot setback. There's a reason for that, because when they were built, the 15-foot setback was not in effect. That came in effect with the 2007 design guidelines. So virtually every structure built in the phase one buildings, which is the Seavers home and the Gaudens home, would be inside of the 15-foot structure. At that time, the City of Fort Worth zoning would have applied, and it has a 5-foot setback. And those complied with the 5-foot setback. They do not comply with the 15-foot setback and do not need to. So the good cause shown is the ACC as a committee, and this is laid out in Mr. Ross's affidavit, as a committee, in order to, once the 2007 design guidelines do go into effect, if you are going to strictly apply, and that is what the Seavers are asking for, is strict compliance. Ironically, as a homeowner, they're asking for strict compliance with ACC provision, with the deed restrictions. To require strict compliance means that virtually no phase one improvement can go vertically straight up. And that is an absurd result.
So if that's good cause that it was in phase one, how do you respond to Mr. Bobo's reference in the record to two instances wherein 2.1 was applied to a phase one remodel?
I would challenge Mr. Seavers' counsel to point the court where that evidence says those are phase one structures. He has said that in his brief. I have looked very closely at that portion of the record, at the clerk's record, and there are a number of submissions and supposed plans listed in there. I've seen a phase 24 listed in those plans. I've seen a phase 5, I believe. I have not seen phase 1 on any of those structures that he's talking about. I'm not saying they're not phase 1, but the summary judgment record does not seem to list them as phase 1 construction. Now, can there be an instance, for example, there are empty lots in phase 1. What to do with an empty lot in phase 1, I think, is the more interesting question, and how the ACC would handle that for new construction, which has no footprint, because it's an empty lot and you're building a new structure on it. I don't know how to handle those.
Is there anything in any of your HOA documents that actually says that 2.1 does not apply to phase 1?
No, not expressly. It is a basic contract principle as well as statutory interpretation principle, as this court knows, that no interpretation should result in an absurd result. To strictly demand that all phase 1 structures must be, even for improvements, must be at a 15-foot setback would require an absurd result. It would also violate one of the biggest common law principles for homeowners, which is, as this court has stated many times, all doubts are resolved in favor of free and unrestricted use of land. Every phase one owner would have that common law principle obliterated if they cannot build up vertically simply because their original structure is inside of 15 feet, even though that original structure was built years ago and is not out of compliance because the 15-foot was not in effect at that time. What the Seavers are asking for is that any improvements be built backwards, either backwards or not built at all, because anything inside of 15 feet cannot be built straight up vertically, which is exactly what the plans were for this. The ACC handled it that way because to do otherwise in the Gaudens case, to do otherwise would have been arbitrary and discriminatory. Mr. Ross's affidavit lays out, this is summary judgment record, lays out that this is how they've always handled phase one, ever since the original phase one were built and then the 2007 design guidelines went into effect. This is the procedure they have handled. This is the way they've done it. And to treat the Gaudens differently, to single them out and say, you know what, your neighbor got to build vertically, your other neighbor got to build vertically, they're in phase one. Virtually everybody has been treated the exact same way in phase one, but we're not going to let you build that way. That's arbitrary and discriminatory.
When the Seavers receive these documents, or anyone else buying in Mira Vista receive the documents that say one thing, they can't rely upon that. They're supposed to know what may have happened in the past, and they can't rely upon the documents that are provided to them as restrictions.
I agree with you, Justice Gabriel. The more prudent course in the future would probably be to clarify for phase one and expressly state it as such. But it is routine in a neighborhood for certain homes to be grandfathered in, or they would not be in compliance if they built it today, but 10 years ago when they built, they were in compliance and therefore remain in compliance, and that's not unusual to be grandfathered in, and nothing in the deed restrictions, covenants, or guidelines that tells anyone moving into the neighborhood that that's the case.
Well, grandfathering in is different than expanding, even if it's up, correct?
It is not exactly the same. I agree with that, yes. But the truth of the matter is, to tell the phase one owners that they cannot build up, it straight up, even though they were in compliance when they moved in and they already had the structure built long ago, is to restrict their use of the land. And that, again, violates a common law principle, and the ACC expressly has the discretion to waive certain procedures. Now, the way they would have run afoul of that is, because it's not unfettered discretion, even if it expressly says they have unfettered discretion, they still don't get unfettered discretion. They have to act in a reasonable way, which the statute says, Property Code 202.004A, says the presumption is it's reasonable, but you cannot act in an arbitrary or capricious or discriminatory way. For the Gaudens specifically, not globally, how do we handle phase one, but for the Gaudens specifically and their plans, to tell them that everybody else in phase one has been able to do it, but you're not allowed to do it. We are going to single you out and treat you differently. We are not going to give you a streamlined process. We are not going to allow you to build up vertically, even though your house was in compliance when it was built. That's arbitrary.
Was there any evidence submitted of other homes that had built vertically, a second-story addition, that were about this close to a neighbor's fence?
I'm not sure that there's exact evidence of other homes. Mr. Ross's affidavit certainly lays out other homes. I don't know if the plans themselves are in the record, Your Honor.
Because it seems to me that your position is perhaps ignoring the qualitative difference of having a taller structure that can see into your yard and is so close to your yard as opposed to a one-story.
Well, certainly building vertically is the way to not increase the footprint, expand the footprint. But there are height restrictions in the deed restrictions, and there is no dispute that these did not violate the height restrictions. Those are already accounted for in different restrictions and covenants, and those were not challenged, and there's no allegation that those were violated. In fact, there's evidence in the record the ACC specifically took into account that the height restrictions were not violated.
Counsel, I'd like to take you back to, a question that Justice Gabriel asked Mr. Bobo. And you've given us several examples where it sounds like every time that this has come before the ACC, the waiver or variance has been granted. Question that Mr. Bobo was asked was regarding, doesn't a buyer, purchaser of a home in Mira Vista have the right and understanding to rely upon the guidelines and restrictions in the future going forward? And how is it not arbitrary and capricious if in every case we have somebody that violates the guidelines, does not go through the proper procedures to seek a variance or waiver, and every single example you've given us is that the type of building and construction sought to be done and indeed completed in this case was completed regardless of what's in the guidelines? How is that not arbitrary and capricious? It seems to me you can make a good argument these guidelines don't mean anything.
Well, they do mean something, and I appreciate the fair point you're making. But let's be clear, they did seek a waiver or a variance. I mean, they sought an application. They did not comply initially. And part of the evidence of the reasonableness is that the POA, the ACC called them on it, and they didn't rubber stamp it. And they didn't turn a blind eye, and they didn't ignore it. They told them, cease immediately. They fined the builder, and they said, we need to see plans. We have no idea what you're building. Submit plans. They looked at the plans. They held a meeting. Now, if they don't do some of those things, there's a point where it does become arbitrary, capricious, or discriminatory if this is done behind closed doors, if you treat different homeowners differently than others. I appreciate the point that it can't be unfettered discretion, and they can't say we have these compliance procedures, but we can tell you you don't have to comply anytime we want to. But that's where arbitrary and capricious comes into play. If they're handling it differently for different homeowners and they're not going through a reasonable process, it is not the decision that has to be right. That's strict compliance. That strict breach of contract, and either you comply or you don't. Well, that would eliminate the presumption of reasonableness in the statute. The statute says the process itself has to be non-arbitrary, not capricious, and not discriminatory. Did they go through a process that was reflective, that considered it, that did not show favoritism to certain homeowners to the exclusion of others? Do I think it perhaps is a little unfair to non-phase one owners that they move into the neighborhood and they don't know that phase one is given a little bit of, I don't want to call it preferential treatment, but they're given a little bit of a pass because they've been grandfathered in and are allowed to then build vertically, perhaps.
Would that make these the guidelines ambiguous then?
Nobody's argued they're ambiguous in this case. Mr. Siever's counsel has not, and we don't argue they're ambiguous. I don't think they're ambiguous. They're clear on their face. But the ACC is given discretion to waive certain procedures. They are not allowed to waive the process entirely. That's not what Article 5.15 says. But they can waive certain procedures in a non-arbitrary, non-capricious, and non-discriminatory way. And the only evidence that Mr. Siever's has pointed to is that the decision itself was wrong and did not strictly comply with the contract. Well, that's not arbitrary. That may be that it wasn't strictly complied with, but there is a presumption of reasonableness. Was the process reasonable? Was everybody given an opportunity to be heard? And did they make a decision that was consistent with how they have handled it in the past and does not lead to an absurd result? I think the answer to all those questions is the process was reasonable, and to not allow any vertical building in Phase 1 is an absurd result. I have two questions.
So in the record, is there any evidence where they have waived this in the past or they've allowed this in Phase 1 in the past where you had a neighbor who was protesting that, basically?
I'm not aware about the protest part. Mr. Ross's affidavit certainly lays out a number of times in the past of how Phase 1 has been handled, consistent with how it was handled here.
Okay, but we don't know of any instance where someone was fighting that, a neighbor was.
I'm not aware in the record of that.
Okay, his time's up, but I have one more question. Can I ask? Okay, what is your response to the 2.9, the AC units or the pool equipment or whatever not being adjacent to the house? Is that not a violation?
By strict compliance, it may very well be a violation.
Is that another waiver that they did because they've always done that in the past?
I think it would fall in that category, yes.
Is there something in the record to support that? Is there is Mr. Ross's testimony on the other issue?
I don't know if he specifically addresses that. I can certainly look and address it in rebuttal. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he specifically addresses the pool issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yanoff. All right, Mr. Drez, is it Drez?
May it please the court. So I want to, in my 5 minutes, start with a little bit of context because I think that's important. The Gaudens bought their home in 2006, remodeled in 07, and the Siever's bought their property in, I believe it was July of 2013. And then nine months later, this all erupted. But the key point I want to make there is the Siever's house and the Gaudens house are the same distance today as they've always been from one another. And if you go and strictly enforce these rules and require the Gaudens tear off their vertical addition, do you then require they tear off the rest of the home that encroaches upon the 15 feet? And the summary judgment evidence is that the Siever's home itself is within or is closer than 15 feet. Do you also lop off part of their home?
I think the Siever's have asked that the original addition that was there when they bought their house and they knew it was there be altered or chopped off, as you say. Have they?
It's unclear to me because the declaratory relief, which is a key point, asks that the Gaudens home be returned to its previous condition. I don't know if that means 2006, 2007, what it means, but that is a request for relief that was maintained even after the Gaudens were non-suited. The merits don't so much apply to the Gaudens anymore in light of the non-suit. And I think there's really three questions. One, did they have affirmative claims at the time the non-suit was filed? And the answer to that question is yes, both a counterclaim under the Declaratory Judgments Act for attorney's fees, as well as a claim for fees under Section 12.05 of the declarations. Did those claims survive the non-suit? They did. This court has made clear that even in spite of a non-suit, affirmative claims for attorney's fees will survive. To be clear, this court has spoken as to declaratory judgment claims. I could not find a case out of this court as to a standalone claim for fees under a contract on that issue specifically. And then the third question, and I submit the main question perhaps this court has to grapple with, is were the Gaudens the prevailing party? And I think there's primarily two reasons or two scenarios under which the Gaudens are the prevailing party. And one is the decision on the merits as to Mira Vista's claim. When Mira Vista obtained summary judgment, the Seavers were not in a position to relitigate their claims concerning the Gaudens' compliance or noncompliance with the declarations. And the language of Section 1205 is important because it says, with respect to any litigation hereunder, the prevailing party shall be entitled to recover reasonable attorney's fees from the non-prevailing party. The Gaudens' counterclaim was conditioned on the Seavers taking nothing, or that the court determined the Seavers' claims are without merit. That occurred in this case.
Can I stop you for a minute, Mr. Reyes? And perhaps this jumps ahead to the Declaratory Judgments Act. My understanding that the law is under the Declaratory Judgments Act, the trial judge has broad discretion as to whether to award those fees or not. And in this case, we do have an order from Judge McCoy in which she explicitly denied requests for fees. So hasn't she already made a ruling on this, and why is it not part of her discretion to determine whether those should have been awarded or not?
I agree with Your Honor on the declaratory judgment claim. I think that 12.05 is the more important issue. I think I agree the trial court has the discretion. I think this court would be well within its bounds to affirm Judge McCoy on the declaratory judgment portion of it. But as to 12.05, that is a mandatory fee provision. The only discretion the fact finder is given is what is reasonable as to the amount of those fees. Did I answer your question, Justice?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
So as to prevailing party status, in KB Home, the Supreme Court didn't say you have to recover money. It talks about that did the outcome materially alter the relationship? And it did, because the Gaudens were no longer faced with the prospect of their home remodeling being stopped, remodeling being reversed, or undone for that matter. So I think the Texas Supreme Court has been clear as what is prevailing and what is not prevailing. Judge McCoy, in her letter ruling said the Seavers did not prevail. But I also find, this is me quoting her, that no party prevailed. Well, if the Seavers did not prevail, somebody had to prevail here. I mean, the Gaudens certainly prevailed in terms of stopping those efforts, and I see that I'm out of time already.
Go ahead and finish your statement, please, or your thought.
Well, my only other thought, Justice Livingston, was related to the non-suit. And in Epps, the court basically said that if it's shown the claims were without merit from the outset, then the non-suit is perceived to be to avoid an unfavorable ruling. You had counsel's statements 2 months into the case that the Gaudens did nothing wrong. The Seavers in their deposition were asked, did you know about the claim for attorney's fees? No. Non-suit followed 8 days later. So I think there is evidence from which the court could have and should have found the non-suit was taken to avoid an unfavorable ruling.
And did you all object to the non-suit?
We did, Your Honor. And that was the subject of our motion to vacate. Okay. And it was, we objected to the non-suit on the grounds that the proposed order on non-suit given to Judge McCoy said all parties bear their own cost. And that was a specific portion because we deemed that a ruling in essence on our affirmative claims for relief.
And presumably, is it your position that no matter what happens in our rulings, that the Gaudens' home could not be touched since they have been non-suited?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Bobo, I believe.
Really quickly, I want to address two things on Mira Vista's arguments and then go to the attorney's fees. First, it's not an absurd result because we're not saying you can't go vertical. You just can't go vertical within 15-foot side setback. It's a 4,000-square-foot house. They put 2,000 square feet on top of it. You could do a remodel inside the 15-foot setback. There's no, we're not trying to say you can ever add in a second story. So it doesn't lead to an absurd result at all. And second, it goes to the point of the other phase one. I can read a map. I can see phase and lot numbers. That's how I came up with the examples. I'd urge the court to do the same thing. And what those are, some of them are like, one of them 2 inches out on a bay window. The point is you go through the process. If you go through the process the way it's laid out, then all those things are taken into consideration. Where the home sits, what is that going to look like compared to everything else? That's the whole process, and that's why it's put in place the way it is. As to the Gowden's attorney's fees issue, they rely on the Epps case, and they waive their right to appeal because the Epps case is very clear. The defendant must file a motion and obtain a ruling from the trial court that the plaintiff's non-suit was taken to avoid an unfavorable ruling. The Epps court is very clear on this. Yes, they filed a motion to vacate, but there was never a motion asking the trial court to find that the plaintiff, the Seavers, filed their non-suit, and there was never a ruling obtained by the trial court. And the Epps court specifically says that has to happen. And the motion to vacate doesn't get there. That issue's waived. I don't think that the Gowdens get to bring this before the court. Secondly, their reliance on Epps, you don't get there, and here's the reason why. The Epps court lays out the factors that you can get there, none of which apply in this case. We filed before summary judgment. We didn't have to respond to discovery. They never sent any. We designated experts. The deadline hadn't passed. There was no procedural obstacles. All the things the Epps court comes up with, we passed. And you hit on a very, very important point with all these cases, especially if you go to Epps and Falls County. This court will have to find that Judge McCoy abused her discretion to overturn her order. And she specifically lays out in her order, nobody prevailed. And that bleeds over into this argument why this is important in her ruling that she got there. And it addresses the Mira Vista 12.05 issue as well. You can't be a prevailing party, and the case law in Texas is very clear, unless the party, she put the parties back in their position. Mira Vista can't point to, nor can the Gowdens, show that the court granted any meaningful relief, i.e., that something that materially altered the party's legal relationship. And the case law is very clear about this standing, and that didn't happen. Judge McCoy was very clear what she said. I don't think we prevailed. Here's the reason why. The position of the parties didn't change. This is my ruling. Everybody bears their own cost. She didn't abuse her discretion. That's what this court has to find that she did. It was a well-reasoned layout of where she came to the conclusion she came to on the attorney's fees. Also, as to Mira Vista's claim for attorney's fees, which I think I'm having to address now, it's essentially the American rule. We sued, they defended, okay, they won, defendant is not entitled to attorney's fees in that claim. The claims both the Gowdens and Mira Vista make back are basically mere claims. The court's familiar with all the cases that you can't just make a mere claim for attorney's fees purposes. The last thing I would say before my time runs out is, simply put, case law is clear that when you subject yourself to governing documents in HOA, that's binding, and they've got to say what they got to say. And if you want to go outside what those documents say, there's a mechanism Mira Vista could change. If they wanted to have a modified process, if they wanted to say 2.1 didn't apply, they can go through, they can make those changes. There's nothing in these documents that say what they are asking this court to hold, either 2.1, 2.9, the approval process. There's absolutely nothing other than saying it's a rule of thumb, we've always done it that way, yeah, we can't point to anything in that process. If this summary judgment is upheld and a ruling comes out that, yeah, it doesn't say it, but the HOA can do it, then you're basically telling a homeowner, whatever those documents say that you're here to, that doesn't matter, because they can make the change if they want to. And the second part of that is on this, the chilling effect of the attorney's fees, just as an equitable argument. What are they supposed to do? I got a document that says here's what's supposed to happen. You tell me no. You don't tell me no under these documents, and I got to challenge it. And, oh, by the way, you're going to be on the hook for those fees and those fees. That would have a very chilling effect on anybody ever trying to challenge an HOA's, in this case, extreme arbitrary decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bobo. Let's see, Mr. Yanoff.
Thank
Before addressing attorney's fees, I'll pick up where I left off with Justice Gabriel's question about the pool equipment. Section 2.9 of the design guidelines says any exterior mechanical equipment utilized must be ground-mounted adjacent to the residence. It does not say abut, it says adjacent, and must be enclosed by walls, fencing, or significant landscaping of sufficient height and density to screen the equipment from view and to buffer sound as well. The Ross affidavit does address this at Clerk's Record 334. He says the configuration of the pool equipment is the same as it was when the Seavers purchased the house in 2013. The Seavers have not submitted to the ACC any applicable requirement data or information that would support a finding that the Gaudens violated the requirement with respect to equipment placement or noise level, because the Seavers have landscaping on the north side of their lot which screens the view of the Gaudens pool and air conditioning equipment. No additional fencing under the guidelines is required. That's at Clerk's Record 334. On the attorney's fees, it's important to note that this is not a claim for attorney's fees under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. And so the American rule doesn't apply to general attorney's fees under common law or even under a statute. There's a contract in place. And the contract says that fees are recoverable, and it says specifically, enforcement of the covenants, this is section 12.5 of the covenants, shall be by a proceeding initiated by any owner. That's what happened here. The Seavers brought a lawsuit. And then it says, with respect to any litigation hereunder, the prevailing party shall be entitled to recover reasonable attorney's fees from the non-prevailing party. I think, Justice Pittman, you were asking it in a different context. But for Mira Vista specifically, the trial court had no discretion to deny attorney's fees. The trial court had discretion on what to award in attorney's fees. But the statute is clear that the prevailing party shall be entitled to recover reasonable attorney's fees. The fact question becomes, what are the reasonable attorney's fees in this case? The issue simply is for the court whether or not Mira Vista is a prevailing party. And there's lots of ways the courts have defined it, but all of them make Mira Vista a prevailing party in this case. One who successfully defends a case against it. Mira Vista was sued for declaratory judgment and a number of causes of action, including breach of contract, negligent misrepresentation, breach of fiduciary duty. It defeated every single one of them in a merits-based full summary judgment. That is a prevailing party. And case after case, the Amarillo Court of Appeals, this is cited at our reply brief at pages 8 through 9, the Amarillo Court of Appeals has set a take-nothing judgment on claims asserted by a plaintiff when there is a contract attorney's fees provision like this. A take-nothing judgment is a prevailing party. San Antonio Court of Appeals, same thing. Austin Court of Appeals, same thing. Houston First Court of Appeals, same thing. Tyler Court of Appeals, same thing. And then Epps versus Fowler, the Texas Supreme Court has said a defendant who is the beneficiary of a non-suit with prejudice is a prevailing party. Well, if a defendant who obtains a non-suit with prejudice is a prevailing party, certainly the Supreme Court would hold that a defendant who defeats claims on summary judgment is a prevailing party as well. If it was only a declaratory judgment action, it may be a different analysis based on Justice Pittman's question of the discretion that a trial court may have on a declaratory judgment action. But these are statutory attorney's fees. If this court affirms that, then we shall be entitled to recover reasonable attorney's fees, and a remand would be appropriate for the trial court to, in her discretion, determine what those reasonable fees are. We ask that the court affirm the summary judgment and reverse on the order denying attorney's fees. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yanoff. All right, Mr. Drez.
May it please the court. Epps, I think we have different interpretations of what Epps here says. It says a defendant may be a prevailing party when the plaintiff non-suits without prejudice and the trial court determines on defendant's motion that the non-suit was taken to avoid an unfavorable ruling on the merits. the Godin's motion for summary judgment expressly said the non, I mean, it's the same arguments we were making here of why the non-suit was taking to avoid an unfavorable ruling. The motion, or the reply in support of summary judgment, same thing. The motion to vacate, same thing. So the court had before it motions making the point that the non-suit, I don't think Epps requires you to file a motion to determine whether non-suit was taken. I think it can be incorporated within a dispositive motion, like a summary judgment, and that was done here. Also along the line in Epps, there was a discussion about Epps getting into a number of factors. What Epps said was a number of factors may support an inference that a plaintiff has non-suited in order to avoid an unfavorable ruling. And then the court went on to say, evidence that the suit was not without merit when filed may indicate that the defendant has not prevailed and is therefore not entitled to attorney's fees. Well, the converse should be true. And that's the evidence we put before the trial court, and that's referred to in our briefs here. The admissions 2 months after the case was filed that the Godins did nothing wrong, the deposition testimony that they had done nothing wrong, they had gotten all the required approvals of the Architectural Control Commission, and the fact that the deposition testimony shows that it appears to have been the first time the Seavers were aware of this affirmative claim for attorney's fees. This, I think, based on the posture of the case here, it has to be viewed in terms of, going back to Justice Pittman, your question about the declaratory judgment claim and Judge McCoy's discretion. If you look at the bases upon which the court granted that summary judgment, there were three arguments advanced. One, that the Godins had no pending claim for affirmative relief, and that's clearly wrong based on the law in this court and many others. Two, the Godins were not the prevailing party. I think that is the issue, both under the Declaratory Judgments Act and under 1205 of the declarations. And then three, that the Godin's declaratory judgment claim was a defensive mirror. The Godin's requested no declarations. There could not have been a mirror image problem. So the trial court got it wrong in granting the Seavers motion when it determined that the Godin's were not the prevailing party. I think that's the issue to focus on here.
Mr. Drez, under the case law, does it matter whether the non-suit was with prejudice or without prejudice?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think if it's with prejudice, it's no question. You're prevailing. Without prejudice, there's a weighing of various evidence, et cetera, that has to happen. And that's what Epps teaches is, you know, although you wouldn't assume a non-suit without prejudice could cause someone to be a prevailing party, they can if the burden that's laid out in Epps is carried. And we believe it was carried here. I'm trying to see here if I've got anything else I want to touch on since I'm the last one up. We've provided the court with numerous cases. Bacon-Thompson's is one relied on that shows that even a TTLA or Theft Liability Act claim for fees, you can be the prevailing party by virtue of the non-suit there. The Cambio case talks about it in the context of a contractual counterclaim solely for fees under the contract, which is what the Godins had here. And the logical purpose seems to be of 12.05 that when there's a dispute under these declarations, and this clearly was one, the prevailing party is entitled to its fees and the non-prevailing party is not. And the Seavers lost. They did not prevail under their claims and declarations, as against the Godins and as against Mira Vista. So we would ask the court reverse the decisions of the trial court as to the attorney's fees issue and remand the case so that the question of the Godins' fees can be determined by the finder of fact. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Drez. Thank you to all of the counsel for all of your arguments and all the briefing that you have undertaken in this matter. Your case is now submitted, and you all are excused.
Thank you.